following was produced by Pirate Radio Studios Incorporated in Memphis, Tennessee.
Hello, my name is Rick Cheddar, and this is From Radioland.
Greetings, salutations, hello, hey, how's it going? Welcome to another episode from Radioland, from the home office in Memphis, Tennessee, which is where all this happens. You know, it's the way we roll around here. Hope it's going well there for you. I have a good show lined up for you guys today. Yes, indeed. Got a couple of legendary performers in the studio. Mark Anthony Lee and Willie Covington. Willie was in... He was in the Platters. We talked about it. It's fantastic stuff. We're gonna have a good time with them here a little bit later on. Got kind of a whimsical situation I want to lay out here for you. I don't know if it's whimsical. It's kind of a no-brainer. I had gotten a friend request on Facebook. That's where that usually happens. Which, by the way, I think my Facebook days are about to be numbered. Oh, Lord. Any rate, as happens, I get requests, you know, and I go through them. You know, I try and vet them as much as I can. You know, if it's an account that hasn't, you know, been around that long and, you know, that's, I don't know, here, look at my boobs. It's, you know, that's not happening. But any rate, this guy sent me a friend request, and I was going through his stuff, and you know, I was looking through his, see what kind of a guy he is, see what this guy's all about. Am I interested in seeing this guy's post if Facebook were to show them to me? And as it turned out, no, I wasn't. I wasn't going to enjoy the experience. Let's put it that way. And so I deleted it, and I don't know, a few days later, I got another friend request from the guy, of which I promptly deleted. And then I got a message from the guy, and I accepted it. I accepted the message. I was like, what? What do you want? You know, he's like, why are you not friending me? And I said, I have a fairly strict no Nazi policy. And boy, howdy, you know, not only he blocked me. I can't see his stuff anymore. Not that I want to. I'm serious. I have developed a fairly strict no Nazi policy. What do you mean by fairly strict? Well, the idea here is that if you're going to make a joke about the Nazis, I'd like to see that. But if you're in support of Nazi ideals, fascist ideals, I'm not gonna do that. There are people who have died protecting this country from people like that, and I don't want to be associated with them at all. I really don't. And in this, what are you laughing for? It's Nazis. Nazis are hysterical because today's Nazi is not like the Nazis of yore. of way back. You know, they do have one thing in common from the 30s to now. They're stupid. They're pretty stupid people. They really are. If you need a primer on what Nazism is, I'm not going to be the one to give it to you because I just don't care for them. I don't care for their ideals. We live in this society now that thing in the White House has made it where it's okay to be a Nazi because he's going to support you. That's what his base is. His base is, you know, he's like, aren't you afraid you're going to piss off somebody with that kind of talk? No, I'm not. Because really, they're in the minority. Okay, there's only about 30% of this country that actively supports that thing in the White House, and the number is shrinking. And out of that 30%, you know, a good third of them are Nazis. And I'm not into that. I forget who said it. Forgive me I got the quote right, but I forgot who said it best. But he said recently that, I think it was Tom Brokaw, maybe? or Dan Rather, I don't know, one of the two. He said that we have gone from we the people to me the president. And you know, he's like, I don't have a problem with Nazis. They're okay. There's some good Nazis out there. That's what he says. And as far as I can tell, as far as I know, there's not a good one out there. There never has been. Never will be. Not when they have that type of attitude. Not when they have that, I don't know, I'm going to hold to it. I have a no-Nazi policy. I'm going to keep it that way. And if you don't like it, go fuck yourself. That's how it is. I'm not afraid to stand up to these people and tell them that they're all a bunch of losers. I have no issues with that. None whatsoever. It's just how the world works, and such as it is. Right. Okay, kids. Let's get into the real part of the program, shall we? We had a great conversation with Mr. Mark Anthony Lee, who is responsible, really, for the roller disco thing. He really is. We'll talk about that. He worked in Hollywood for a while too. He's a great cat. He's been on the program before, but he brought a friend with him, and he's another great gentleman by the name of Willie Covington, great singer, sang with a bunch of acts throughout the day, including the Platters. We'll talk about all of that, and we'll have us a grand old time with Mark Anthony Lee and Willie Covington right here from Radioland. Get on the Memphis Brew Bus. Every Saturday at 2 p.m., we'll take a 3.5-hour adventure through the Memphis craft brewery scene. The Memphis Brew Bus stops at 3 local breweries for some special behind-the-scenes tours, talks with the master brewers, and, of course, tasting of their signature brews. While on the bus, you'll hear stories and learn about the history of beer. Plus, you'll get some music from the Radio Memphis Library. Go to memphisbrewbus.com and find them on Facebook. The Memphis Brew Bus. We'll drive you to drink.
Hi, Natalie. How are you?
Hey, Rick. I'm doing great.
You're doing good?
How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. Did you have a good week?
Oh, God. It just went by so fast.
It was Halloween.
I know. And did you have trick-or-treaters?
I did.
Yeah?
I had some that braved the rain. They came out when it, you know, right before it rained and then after it rained.
Yeah.
And I was probably a good 15, 20 of them, I guess. Good kids, you know.
I had a few, but then I got antsy, and I ended up going to a sidecar, and here Delta Project was playing up there.
They'll be here next week.
Yeah, oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That'll be a big show.
Okay, great. You know, Steve's still kind of recovering.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. So, you know, hopefully he'll be in better shape for next week. We'll see.
Oh, yeah.
Today is Leo Goff's birthday.
Oh, happy birthday, Leo.
Yeah, he's celebrating a birthday, as is Guy Venable.
Oh, I love
Guy. Guy Venable from Zeno and the White Guy.
Yes.
So yeah, he's celebrating a birthday today. Here in studio, Mark Anthony Lee is here, and Willie Covington is here.
What's up?
Fellas?
What's going on?
How are you?
All right.
Hanging out.
Hanging out, causing trouble?
Yeah.
Yeah, I know you.
Trouble's my middle name.
You got some trouble. You're getting ready to start up over at Graceland.
Yeah, we're gonna be in there next week. We're doing the annual W.C. Handy Heritage Music Awards. We got some people coming in gonna help us out. We got Willie Carlson gonna get an award this year, and we got Danny Mac and we got Zeno and the guy with the band. We got James Jackson.
Did you say Janet Jackson?
James Jackson. Other King Bees and
yeah,
Solomon.
Yeah.
Other King Bees and Lafayette on drums and horn section. Array of characters and we're just gonna try to have some fun. You know.
You do this every year, don't you? You do the music for this whole thing, right?
Yeah, I'm a music director. We put it together 20 years ago, and we've been doing it in different venues. This year we're gonna be the guest house here over at Graceland.
Yeah,
and it's gonna be a nice affair, I believe.
Yeah,
you know, cause I'm looking for a new Aretha, a young Aretha.
Yeah,
you know, and there's always room for some new talent. That's what it's all about, to keep the Memphis blues and the Memphis R&B alive.
Yes.
Well, that's kind of what we do here with this.
Yeah, of course. That's why I like your show so much.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. And
So you put this I guess an orchestra together with a band,
yeah,
for this thing.
I'm gonna have at least 8 to 10 pieces, I think, this year.
And you do all the scoring for it, or you just
Memphis score I mean, everybody already can play. You just organize them and
Tell them what they're playing.
Yeah, tell them what they're playing and arrange those. I've been known to arrange some music, you know, in my day.
Yeah. And yeah, so I know you did. Yeah.
And we make it work, you know, have fun with it. That comes first.
Well, sure.
And we expect to this year, so let's roll.
Well, yeah, let's go. When is he says next weekend? Is that right?
Next Sunday at about 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock.
Yeah,
we just kick off about 7 o'clock, and you can get your tickets. You can call Heritage Tours for Miss Lane Turner. The number is 527-3427. You can just call anytime and tell them you're interested in the show, and like I said, I'm looking for the new Aretha Franklin.
Yeah.
A young Aretha Franklin, between 18 and 30.
Yeah.
If you come to the gig, you might get lucky.
Well, if you're in the room, yeah, you'll probably get lucky.
Yeah. I'm talking about the singing. we're always looking for new talent, the people that's emerging, you know.
Oh, yeah. It's a lot of talent here, you know,
yeah,
that.
Memphis is junk full of it. I'll never forget, though. We did the Isaac Hayes back in 2001, and he just said, man, y'all don't know the Alpha Memphis. They said, there's so many stories in Memphis
that
you can make movies out of.
Right.
You know, so I said, one day Memphis is going to be real big for movies. Matter of fact, the other day, did you see this thing on Channel 3? They found a movie classic.
No, I didn't see this.
All black cast, 1928.
Really?
Well, guess what?
What?
It was a talkie.
Oh, really?
It was one of the first talkie film right in Memphis.
Is that right?
King Vidor did it.
Oh, wow.
Man, you know, back in the day, he was what's happening. And I saw it, and they showed some of it on TV.
Was there music in it?
It was a talkie. Yeah, it was a movie. It's like a... about a preacher and a lady singer, a jazz singer or something, blues singer or something.
Okay.
And I never heard of it. I said, what a talkie. That picture was nominated for Academy Award.
Is that right?
In 1929, that's what they said.
And it was made here?
Made here in Memphis.
Wow.
That was a revelation.
What was the name of the movie? Do you remember?
I don't know. Hallelujah, Hallelujah.
Hallelujah?
Yeah. You know, It looked like it was good.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm, if anybody knows, you know, where can I see this picture? Maybe Channel 3 would give us information.
Maybe.
Yeah, since they aired the
It may be on YouTube.
It may be.
It's out of the public domain, or it's in the public domain.
It's in the public domain.
Yeah.
And, That was news to me.
Yeah. News to me too.
Huh. I'm always fascinated by Memphis history.
Yeah, of course. You know, back then, Memphis the hub of American music.
Yeah.
You know, so like we got the king of rock and roll, the king of the blues,
That's right.
The queen of soul.
Yes, sir.
Mm. And she was. She lived, well, of course, everybody knows the story by now. She was born here, and they're trying to do something with that house.
Mm-hmm. I wish they would.
They will.
I hope they can just clean it up and leave it right where it is. It'd be good for the neighborhood.
You know, that's politics.
I know it is.
You know, but I just wonder how it's going to turn out, that's all.
Yeah.
You know, it can't do but help. We'll just see what's happened, so.
You brought a friend down here with you tonight.
Yeah, I brought my old friend. We cut an album together with Galaxy. And,
Back in the day. I used to live on this street, Lucy.
Did you live on Lucy? Yeah.
Yeah, when I was a baby.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't know Aretha then.
Yeah.
But wish I had, you know. But I was a kid, a baby, back in that day.
Yeah.
Yes, I was with Galaxy. We recorded Hot, Wet, and Sticky, the album. We did that.
And You and Me.
You and Me, L-O-V-E, Love.
Yeah, that's the song I was trying to think of.
L-O-V-E, Love, Miss Foxy Lady.
Yeah, that album was it should have been a hit. It was a hit, but it wasn't real known here.
Well, you know, we bought that album in Japan.
Yeah, I know y'all was hit over there. Yeah, and Lock and All was the A&R man, I think.
Yep, yes he was.
What's his name? But you know, you know the guy who runs Arista.
Uh huh.
You know he owned Arista.
Clive Davis. Yeah, we had fun with that group. I love that group. Back in 83, I believe.
Yeah.
And I ended up hooking up with a friend of mine out of Miami. And his name was Jesse Ferguson. I ended up with the Platters. Ended up doing 2 or 3 years with the Platters. Then I caught the ear of a guy by the name of Bobby Ruffin with the Drifters.
Yes.
And I ended up doing the Drifters in Europe and all over Spain, Mallorca, Madrid, Barcelona.
You went all over the world, yeah.
Well, we did our fair traveling.
Oh, yeah.
And then I got on my own and opened up for the Supremes, 3 Degrees in Europe, and just had fun. I'm still doing it,
yeah.
You know, of course.
I've always been a fan of the Platters. Who's ringing? That's a Beatles cut.
Yeah, the Beatles.
I've always been a fan of the Platters, and I know that was an outfit that had been around a long, long time.
Oh, yes, indeed. And that's not the original Platters.
Well, yeah, I mean, because this started like back in the 40s, was it?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, I played a version of the Platters, too, on a Rock and Roll and Remember tour back in the... Well, that was the... must have been the 80s... We toured down through Texas, Brownsville, Laredo, Corpus Christi, and I had to play that the Platters and all the tunes with the Coasters too.
Yeah, the Coasters, the Platters.
Yeah, and also Jerry, Jerry Lewis's son and the Playboys. What's his name?
Oh, Bob. I'm thinking of Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys, but
and then the Playboys. You know, This Diamond Ring.
Yeah.
Gary Lewis.
Gary Lewis. Thank you. Thank you.
The Starlighters.
Yeah, the Starlighters.
What was that band? Joey D and the Starlighters.
Yeah.
Out of New York, you know. And they were on the tour. And who else was on that tour? That was the main ones.
When I first discovered the music of the Platters, it also led me down that road to the Ink Spots. Those three guys were great.
Now, you're bringing all of this now. When I was in California...
I'm not as dumb as I look.
When I was in California, I was on a program with the Ink Spot.
Really?
Over in Fullerton, I think it was.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was some older guys, and they did their show. Because I heard of them. But.
Yeah. And that was all around that same time, and it was the fellas that could sing, and they could harmonize. As we like to call panty-dropping music.
Yeah, we worked with the Ink Spots in Hawaii back in 88.
Yeah.
And that was a very good group.
Oh, I bet. Yeah.
Very good group. All of those songs are really just memorable. You just remember those songs.
Oh, yeah.
Good songs to remember.
Well, it was back in the day when you guys would write something and it stuck.
Right.
You know, it wasn't this plastic... cookie cutter garbage.
Well,
that we
it
do
meant something. It meant something. It had feelings and really it hit home. Told the truth.
Oh, sure. Yeah, because it was about what everybody was feeling at the time.
Of course.
And it was written for that sound. It was it was written for you guys. And you guys did a lot of that writing yourself.
Oh yeah. But it was fun. It was a fun ride though, while it lasted.
Yeah,
it was fun.
You miss it?
Oh, yeah, I do.
Yeah.
Every now and then I get a chance to sing a song or two, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Only You and Great Pretender.
Yeah.
Smoke Gets in Your Eye.
Smoke Gets in Your Eye.
Oh, I love that one.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed.
He was out there with James Austin, too.
Well, shortly with James.
Shortly, yeah.
Yeah.
Because I know he was with the Platters.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Good old times, but... We're trying to do this Memphis thing now and make it work.
You talking about some Bobby Bland and B.B. King? You talking about?
Oh, yeah. Man, that's the music. That's the sound.
That's the sound now. They're not here, but we're still here.
Yeah, still you are. You ain't going nowhere.
Still carrying on.
Well, yeah. And that's and see, I've mentioned this before. I've always loved having, you know, the veterans of the music industry in here, because you guys, you know, have, you know, the fascinating tales of what you survived, what you went through the years. And to a certain extent, it hasn't really changed a whole heck of a lot, you know, for artists. And you know, there's still the crooked venue guys, and then, you know, all of the
rigmarole.
Yeah, the rigmarole that goes with it, and playing shows and not getting paid, and dealing with the record labels and all of that mess. And that stuff's still there, unfortunately. But it was different for you guys, though, too.
Well, it was fun, and we did get paid.
Yeah, but
There was some times, and we would travel and wondering whether or not we was going to get paid.
Yeah.
It was some ups and downs. Yeah. Oh, yes, it was.
Another night in the backseat of the car, right?
Another night.
Yeah.
But it was good, fond memories. And
no doubt. I worked with Bobby Bland a long time. Well, a few years, anyway. And I got to know BBE and new Albert from Stax Recording.
Right.
So I knew some, and I met Chuck Berry once in St. Louis. He played my guitar. He did this little show.
And, he's an interesting dude.
Oh, very. He was good. It was playing like they was pushing him on stage. You ain't got to push Chuck on stage. he wanted to come on stage anyway.
You know, he played right up to his death.
He did.
He played at least once a month at his club up there in St. Louis.
Yeah, Blueberry Hill.
Yeah, the Blueberry Hill.
Yeah, he was a teacher. He taught everybody how to play rock and roll. You know, this guy with the Rolling Stones, Keith Richards, really crazy about him.
Yeah.
And most of them, the guys from England, Jimmy Page, Led Zeppelin, of course, he was influenced on everybody. Him and Little Richard, and Fast Domino, Bo Diddley. So, and this guy from Memphis named Roscoe Brown.
Roscoe Brown.
Yeah. I forgot this song. Yeah, something about a rooster or something. A chicken or something. I forget that song. But that was back, they had it going on in the 50s. And we did shows with Lord Fulson, Willie Dixon, what's his name? Clarksdale Boys or something else.
Oh, yeah.
John Lee Hooker.
Yeah.
You know, when we was in California, I had a chance to meet Ike Turner, like Tina Turner. I met him once.
I did, too.
He's someone.
He and I shared a table at some deal down on Beale Street, and I couldn't help it because he was a very little guy, and I kept thinking, yeah, he was a tiny guy, and I kept thinking, how the hell did Tina Turner not kick his ass? You know, because he was an imposing fellow. I mean, he had the talk. There was no doubt about it. You know, he was sitting with like three women at the table. I mean, it was, you know.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and then you bring up the conversation of the song Rocket 88.
Let's talk about that then.
Yeah, you would bring that up with him, and he would, you know, that was Johnny Brinson and the All Stars, and that was Ike would tell you that is the first rock and roll song.
Yeah, right. That's right. I heard that too. And then Rufus Thomas recorded it later.
Yes,
but that was in my understanding that Rocket 88 was designated as like groundsy for rock and roll songs.
Yeah, that was done, I think, at Sun.
Yes.
Yeah, Sam Phillips did that. Yeah. Did that tune?
I think I bought a T-shirt too with the Rocket Age T-shirt.
And it was right after that Bill Haley and the Comets did the Rock Around the Clock, and then
they
tried to say that was the first rock and roll song.
Oh, dig it!
You know, no, that was not the case, because it was like by a year or two.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
That's still an interesting song to me. Because it's been copied so much.
Oh, yeah.
You know, been re-recorded, I'm talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Rocket 88 kind of, I don't know, I guess after a while it sort of just kind of slid under the rug, and people didn't think much about that.
No, you just...
But when you listen to it, it's a fantastic song.
You know, I love the noise. She makes my rocket daddy eat and all that stuff. Don't you be late and all that stuff. It was quite well conceived, actually. You know. But who actually wrote this song?
It may have been Johnny Brinson. I don't
may
know.
Been John, may have been Johnny Brinson.
It may be.
He recorded it, yeah.
Is it? But, yeah, because he was playing sax.
It was
and
like
I think,
turning in the Kings of Rhythm.
That's what it was. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was the same guys, I think.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. More than likely, because they're just playing what they like.
Oh, well, yeah. You know, and that's and it makes perfect sense that that would be the perfect start to rock and roll.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, I think so, too.
You know, because you look at what happened in the during the Second World War, during the mid-40s, you had all those swing acts out there. And,
yeah.
And that was that bridge between jazz and
rhythm and blues.
And rhythm and blues.
And
blues. Yeah.
Because when B.B. got over to WJIA, it was DJ and put out the commercial called PepsiCon, and then Rufus Thomas, all over on Bill Street.
Yeah.
These talent shows were at the Palace, you know, and said, they discovered Bill... what's his name? B.B. King and Bobby Blue Bland was singing with the Bill Streeters and Junior Parker playing.
Oh, God, Junior Parker, yeah.
Yeah, so they got together and...
And back then, didn't B.B. go by another name that early on, like Little Boy Blue or something like that?
That's what B.B. means, they say. It means blues boy.
Okay.
But his first name was really Riley.
Riley King.
Riley King. Which is still a great blues name, but
yeah,
you know,
still
but
a movie.
Either way, you couldn't lose.
Yeah,
did Elvis get his start at the Palace Theater?
He might have been there. I don't remember, but I know he came up to Memphis from Tupelo, and
I knew Elvis used to spend some time on Beale Street. He would sneak into the back of a lot of the clubs down there.
Yeah.
And, you know, the bouncers would see him. They'd throw his ass out of there.
Right,
you
right.
know, and they'd throw him down into the alleyway. They didn't beat him up or nothing, but they were just like, you need to get on out of here, kid. You know, this ain't for you.
This ain't your gig, huh?
Yeah.
I heard Rufus used to let him come on.
Yeah, and, I believe.
I didn't know that. That's
yeah, at the Palace Theater, and maybe would let him use his guitar.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah.
Yeah, because he took that famous picture by with Elvis and B.B. King together at a good real view or something. And it was taken by Ernest Wills, the late Ernest Wills. And that picture is iconic now, you know.
Oh, yeah. I think there's a copy of it down at that museum.
Yeah. And so.
Yeah, Rufus was another one. That was an interesting cat, man.
Rufus was a real interesting guy.
He put the show in show business, though.
Yeah, I believe it. They used to call him the world's youngest teenager.
Yes.
I know one time I told I was having a way up then, and we was rehearsing at the Rosewood, and I said Rufus, I was in the dance a lot, and I said, Rufus, why don't you teach me how to tap dance? He looked at me. He said, come here, boy. He said, what I do? He said, I don't tap dance for nobody no more. And I said, okay. That'll work.
Well, yeah, because he was, you know,
he
got started in that thing with dealing with like those white managers that would just trot him out there and say, "Come on, dance."
Well, I guess that was when he was younger.
Yeah, when he was younger, when he was a kid, nearly. I think.
Yeah, yeah. But then we started making hit records. He said, "I don't tap dance no more now."
He didn't need to.
Yeah, he need to. He was a star then.
Well, sure.
Because we played some different venues up in Chicago. We played the Stingray Club. And then we played Fort Knox, and we played a whole lot, just because I knew it from Stax. I played a lot of sessions with him at Stax, and then I went on the road with him when I was in the way up, and so we toured all over the place. But Rufus was a character, boy.
He definitely was. He liked the ladies, for sure.
I heard about it. Yeah, he got it.
He was busy.
I heard about it.
He was busy.
That's funny. I need to pause here. When we come back, I was going to play this tune from Galaxy, Willie.
Yeah, you and me.
Yeah, you and me.
Okay, great.
And I found it, and it's on YouTube of all places.
Oh, great.
And somebody said that it was. Oh, what was one of the comments? They said it was more rare than a Brit asking for a rare steak in France. I don't know quite how to take that, but I appreciate it nonetheless. But all it is a cover of the album Hot, Wet, and Sticky with the two ladies
with
on
the
there.
Two ladies.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and it's quite the picture.
We cut that album in Muscle Shoals, by the way.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, we'll come back here in a minute, and we'll talk about that record, and we'll play it, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, I haven't heard it in a while, so
well, you'll get to hear it. Okay. You'll get to hear it in a little bit. Calm down now.
Okay. And you played on it.
Yeah, you played on it. You should know all about it.
We want to be.
There's always a malfunction when I'm around.
It's all right. But that's all right. That's Galaxy, you and me. The notes that come with this song is 1978. Is that right?
78. It was a good year.
Well, it was.
Yes, indeed.
That's a great tune. And it is. It doesn't. I think it holds up well. I know some songs are kind of dated, but that one really, really held up.
It was really nice when Exile did it as well.
It's a classic to me.
It is.
It's got that groove.
It do.
Yeah.
It's a great groove.
When he cut it.
And I noticed something else, too. What kind of dates it a little bit is all the flute work that's in it, because you don't hear it that often anymore.
Nah.
You know, I know that was...
Real instruments.
Yeah, real instruments. Yeah, that's part of it. Yeah. Because it sounds like it was a pretty big outfit of musicians that made
it. Oh, yes, it was.
Yeah, there had to have been
what? About 11 of us.
Yeah?
Yeah, back then, them days.
Where did you do this record?
Well, we cut this at Muscle Shoals.
That was at Muscle Shoals, yeah.
And then we cut it in Memphis, too, didn't we?
Oh, we cut most of it that weekend.
At Ardent?
At a studio in Muscle Shoals. We cut most of these songs. Now, Hot and Wet and Sticky was already cut. In Memphis, is that what you're talking about?
Right,
it was
right.
Already cut. Yeah, I think it was done at Arden or something.
Was that the only album from Galaxy?
Yes, that's about it.
Wow, you guys should have done so much more with that. No offense, but I mean that's good stuff. There should have been just a whole library, a category of that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, we was too busy. Everybody was young and had their own ideals.
Did it sell well?
Oh, it did well in Europe. It did well in Asia.
Yeah, well, I can see that. Yeah,
yeah. You can imagine buying the album cover with written the jacket inside jacket.
Yeah,
written in Japanese writing.
Dig it. Yeah, I
think that was kind of weird.
Yeah. Did you ever get a chance to go to Japan and play there?
Oh yeah.
Yeah,
we did.
The Japanese people, when they get behind something, they go into it all in.
Oh, but they all in.
Hall knows all about that. Yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah. We all know about it.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, indeed. They give their all in all now.
Oh, yeah. They become real fans.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, you leave Memphis, if you're from Memphis, people will know.
You know, I've heard that from a million musicians, and they say the city of Memphis doesn't care about their musicians, but the second you step out of town, man, they're going to roll out that red carpet for you.
Alec Hayes says, man, y'all don't even know y'all from Memphis.
He said, really?
Because people around the world know more about Memphis than we do.
Yeah.
And when I went to Paris, we played at the Lionel Hampton Club on the Champs-Élysées. And this guy, this on the record distributorship, I went to his office, and he had all blues musicians on his wall in his office. Otis Redding was the biggest picture right over his desk. And they had B.B. King and Chuck Berry. He had Muddy Waters. And he was telling me all about the music, all about Memphis and everything.
Yeah.
Because this is where it began.
Oh, yeah, that's where it began.
And, that's why I ran into, he was playing with a Spanish band. That's why I ran into Kurt Whelan, man. And people said, man, that guy is playing it. He's playing his butt off his horn. I said, who is that? I was unpacking. He said, man, you got to come down here to the stage and see who's that. Who's this guy? I said, I don't know who that guy is. And I was listening. I said, man, I know that sound. I mean, I know this. I know this sound. You know what I mean? Look, it's like this. Somebody learned in California. You have your dialect when you, as a musician.
Yes.
They can tell, musicians can tell where you're from. Because I was playing the Jimmy Smith Supper Club one night. And the guy, they made a bet with each other. They knew I was from South Memphis, Arkansas, somewhere.
Yes.
Mississippi, somewhere. I said, yeah, man, I'm from Memphis. I said, yeah, I told you. That's where you from. I play everything. Anyway, I was in there listening to Kurt, and I walked around and I said, let me see who this is. I went around and had Kurt playing up there with him, playing with the Spanish band at the same club, at the Lion Hampton Club over there at the Meridian Hotel. I went back to the bar. I said, oh man, there ain't nobody but Kurt. Man, I know him. He lived down the street.
Yeah, and you know it's so true. I'll see something on television, or I'll see a movie, and you, by hearing the song, you know that's Memphis. There's a Memphis artist in there somewhere.
It has a sound. It has a signature.
Yeah, we off the air. We were talking about Howard Grimes, and Howard was telling me about, you know, how they built that sound.
Yeah.
You know, and it was because it comes up a lot. Why is it that Memphis music is so sought after? And it's the old joke, is it in the water? Is it in the food? No, it's the people. It's there's a mentality about Memphis artists that is not unlike anywhere else in the world.
It's the Memphis sound.
Yeah. You know, that whole, and you know, we're so vastly different from the stuff they crank out of Nashville, you know, and that becomes so plastic and I'm not a fan of what they're doing here. You got studios that'll work in the middle of the night, and they're making, you got artists in it that are grinding it out and sweating it out. Up there, it's a punch a clock deal. It's an 8-to-5 gig. They're in and out, and it's not, it doesn't have the soul to it. It doesn't have the blood and the sweat that goes with it, you know.
That's right.
I got, I made me think of something. Do you remember this? At Stax, when Elvis Presley came in for about a month or so and cut his Stax.
Oh,
that's Willie, right. Yeah, yeah.
Willie, you need to go over here and tell that story.
Come on.
Yeah.
Willie has a great story about Elvis.
Yeah, that one hit his.
Yeah. I think Willie Hall threw him out of the studio.
Hello, everybody.
It's Willie Hall, ladies and gentlemen.
You know, Elvis. Elvis had carte blanche in Memphis. He was truly the king, and anything Elvis wanted, he got in this city, and he truly deserved it. There was one night that Isaac Hayes was recording. Isaac would record from 7 p.m. till 11, well, from 7 at night to almost daybreak in the morning. We wouldn't get a break. We hadn't seen our families in days because Isaac would keep us in the studio all night. We were either rehearsing or recording. And so everybody would love to go home, you know. So one night Isaac was in the studio. You know, he'd eat these Jack Purtle livers, and they'd give him all kinds of energy, you know. And there we were eating bologna sandwiches. hadn't seen our families in a while. So, you know, whenever we could get away from the studio, you know, because Isaac would keep us in there all night, and then in the next morning we'd have a session. We were the studio band, and we'd have sessions with guys like Little Milton, Albert King, The Emotions, whoever. So we wanted a break, and thank God Elvis wanted to come in the studio that night. We were so glad when Jim Stewart came in and told Isaac he had to leave, and Isaac wasn't pleased. You know, he'd say, "Man, MF." Elvis Presley, man, I'm there.
Elvis was in the building.
But he would say that on his way out the door. Yeah. When Elvis came in, everything stopped. So this particular night, Elvis's caravan roll in. You know, they'd come in. They wouldn't use the board at Stax. They'd run their cables through
to the truck, to the RCA truck.
Right, from the RCA truck through those double doors.
Right there on the street, yeah.
Studio.
That's so. Right. Elvis came in that night, and there was a guy named Henry Bush. We call him Creeper.
The Creeper.
Yeah. He had worked his way up from almost a garbage man. He would take the garbage out, and he worked his way up to
an engineer
and producer.
Right.
And he had credits for producing people like Vita Brown, and eventually he produced Albert King. As a matter of fact, he produced the album I'll Play the Blues for You. So he had made plenty of money, and he flaunted it. He had bought him one of these fake mink coats and
a bunch of
jewelry, and he bought him a new checkerboard Cadillac.
Yeah, the Creeper.
Checkerboard top Cadillac. And so he was flaunting his riches around, and everybody was feeling a little low because he was making money, and we were just at a standard. So this particular night, Elvis came in, and I stayed over because Elvis's drummer, Ronnie Tutt, and I were friends. And so the musicians came in early, and they set their stuff up. Ronnie and I were talking, and Creeper, Henry Bush, he was closing out Isaac's session. So Henry and I were leaving, walking down the hall, heading to the front door, and Stax's halls were like a maze. And so,
you get lost in it.
Yeah, because there were no windows, you know. And so we were leaving, walking down the hall, heading out the front door, and Elvis came down the hall. He turned the hall. Man, it seemed like the wind started blowing when Elvis came down the hall. Man, it was like Gone with the Wind.
Chairs of the God.
The wind started blowing. And Elvis, man, I've never seen many pretty men, but he was a pretty man. His skin was flawless like Cassius Clay. And he had on this outfit, it was all camel colored. The hat, the scarf, the coat, the pants, the shoes, the scarf, everything was the same color. And so I was amazed when we were walking down the hall and he turned the corner. I was like, wow, look at this guy, man. He's truly the king, man. I mean, he wore it, you know, yeah. Like a lot of us don't. You know, a lot of us don't wear our popularity. But he wore his, man, and he was a hell of a personality.
Yeah.
Anyway, so he's walking toward us. We're heading for the front door. And the hall at Stacks heading outward was real small. So if there was a person coming towards you and two people were going out, one of us had to stand to the side to let the other one through.
Yeah.
So I stood to the side. So Elvis stopped Henry Bush. He stopped Creeper. Creeper had bought this lapel. I mean, he had brought this brooch. And we all thought it was diamonds because, you know, Henry had flaunted himself so much. So we thought it was, you know,
real
he told
deal.
Us it was, yeah, it was real diamonds. So we walking down the hall. I stood to the side. Elvis came up. Elvis stopped and asked Henry Bush. He said, hey, man, let me see that. So he looked at Elvis's brooch. He said, you know what? I like that. He said, I got one just like it. He said, but mine's real. So naturally, Henry was peed off, you know. And so when Elvis went on down the hall headed for the studio, you know, Henry was mad because Elvis had busted him. So, so Henry said, man, F Elvis. Elvis don't know nothing about no jewelry. Elvis don't know anything about jewelry. My God, man, that's quite the opposite.
Yeah,
that was my Elvis story. Man.
Did you ever have any conversations with him after that, or did you ever get a chance to kind of get to know the man?
No. I never actually met him around him because one of the protocols was that, you know, everybody had to leave the studio.
I was going to get to that.
You weren't really allowed to stay around.
You used to get out of the building at 6 o'clock. Right?
You had to leave.
And so we come back to work in the morning. And so the guys, you know, was it Aaron was one of the guys there.
Uh-huh.
You say, well, Elvis has left the building.
Yeah, and that's a true statement. When
that's
Elvis left the building, man, it was like a ghost town.
Yeah, you know, because he worked in the morning.
He brought such an entourage.
He brought the RCA truck.
You know, it was amazing, man, and I'm sure this happens with all the superstars, superstars. But when these guys come around, man, there's such a heavy entourage. And all the lights are on. You know, when we were there with Isaac, man, they turned the lights down
to
save utilities, you know. But when Elvis came, man, everything lit up. You know? It was like, my God, what's going on? You know, is the president here or something? You know, he demanded that, and it happened.
And he got it, too.
He's a hell of a personality.
It's kind of the same effect with Isaac Hayes to us. See, we came late, see, so Isaac was like the big icon at Stacks.
Yeah, he was.
And so when he bought that blue and gold Eldorado and parked it on Stack Lot.
Yeah.
Man, that was something.
That's the car that's in the museum now, isn't it?
Right now.
With the big headlights on it.
One of the bodyguards for Isaac, his name is John Rawls. Johnny Rawls is what we call him. He was one of the first people to add extensions to cars.
Yes.
Oh, really?
So when Isaac went to Detroit to order his car special, this guy named Johnny was one of the guys that told the engineers at the Detroit factory to add the extension in the middle to one of Isaac's limousines. It was the first time I had seen a stretch limo in my life.
And
Johnny was noted for having that done.
Dig it. That's against the byline.
Yeah.
But Stacks was something else with it. Wasn't
but you know, Isaac was a Leo. He was the ego Leo.
Yeah.
You know, there are two personalities to each zodiac sign.
Yeah.
You know, you got your positive Pisces and you got your negative Pisces.
Right.
You got positive Leo and your negative Leo. I'm sort of like in the middle. I'm a Leo, but I'm not that ego Leo. I wish I was. anyway, Isaac was that ego Leo. And, you know, when Jim Stewart came in, okay, we're in the studio and we rehearse, and Isaac calling out the chords, and he's giving me the beats and whatever, and the tempos and everything. So when Jim Stewart came in the studio to inform Isaac that he had to leave for Elvis's arrival, you know, Isaac was not pleased, you know.
It makes sense to hear you say it like that, yeah, because he was not busy, you know.
He was not pleased because he was the big cheese.
Well, yeah.
You know, Isaac considered himself the big cheese. And, And he had some words to say about Elvis. You know, man, him Elvis Presley. I'm the one who knew that. I'm the one. But like I said, he said that on the way out the door. So
yeah. So I guess when Elvis recorded there at Stax, he did it just because he wanted to record at Stax. Is that
yeah,
what that
because,
was?
Yeah,
because he wasn't a Stax artist by any means.
No, he wasn't a Stax artist. And artist. He had the availability of any studio that he wanted, not only in Memphis.
Because he could have
flown. He could have flown to Nashville and recorded in RCA, but
walk in with a briefcase full of cash, and that was that. Yeah,
I guess you know when you a combination of pills and whatever else, you know, when it hits you, you just pick out a place you want to record. But he came to Stax quite often. A lot of people didn't know that. And Elvis was a night owl. You know, whatever he did was late at night or early in the morning. You know. Even when he would put on the police outfit and go on some of the raids with the Memphis Police Department, he was a night owl.
Really, tell him about the entrance he made with the chair in the back.
This same night about the brooch, when he came to the studio, like I say, I was hanging out with Ronnie Tutt and we were rapping, so I went out to the guardhouse in the back of Stax. And I watched, they amazed me because everything was so together. You know, these guys, I mean, Elvis's entourage was right on it, almost like the FBI or something. You know, everything was like clockwork. So the truck pulled in, they hooked up the board. And then when it was time for Elvis, this huge U-Haul truck came on the lot. And I'm wondering to myself, I said, what the world would they have in the U-Haul truck? So I'm standing there just watching. I'm really amazed. And so all of a sudden, the doors to the U-Haul open, and I looked inside, and there were these vanity lights. When the doors opened, all these bright lights came on. And Elvis was sitting in this like chair with a throne. You know, it was like a throne. You know, high back.
In the back of a U-Haul?
Coming out of, in a U-Haul truck, man, honest to God. And the chair that he was sitting in slid out. And came down. No. I mean, it wasn't like he had to hop down out of anything. Elvis don't hop.
No.
Elvis didn't hop.
Well, that's incredible.
The chair came out. It slid down to the ground. And Elvis, and there were some steps. And Elvis just stepped out of the U-Haul. But the U-Haul back opened. All these vanity lights came on. The chair slid out. And he walked down. It's almost like he was God or something.
Yeah. It was making an appearance even in a parking lot.
Oh, man, late at night like that. I'm talking about 11, 11:30, 12 o'clock midnight.
I'd never heard this. This is
guy
awesome.
He was amazing, man. He was an amazing.
He was the king.
And his whole entourage, as I say, it was an amazing thing to watch because everything happened like clockwork. It was almost like the CIA or something. There were guards everywhere.
Yeah, yeah.
They shut down the whole block, you know. It wasn't going to be no brothers walking around
no,
talking like
no
you got
wasn't.
Some change or something like that. It wasn't going to be none of that, man. It was an amazing feat to watch Elvis Presley.
Wow.
Sir. Good stuff, Willie.
Thank you, Willie.
And it's true. Y'all go ahead.
Elvis had left the building.
You guys want to do a tune?
Let me see. Let's try to tune up something. Do a little blues.
Let's do Members Only.
You want to try that?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a private party. Don't need no money to qualify. Just bring your checkbook, bring your broken heart, 'cause it's members only tonight. So you lost your woman, so you lost your man. Red and yellow, black or white, they're throwing a party for the broken heart, and it's members only tonight. Members only It's a private party. Don't need no money to qualify. Don't bring a checkbook. Bring your only heart. 'Cause it's members only tonight. Members only.
Oh, yeah. What a voice, man.
Oh, man, I'm still asleep. I was in bed when he called me.
That was good.
Like a lot of singers, you pick it up in like in the church or through the family or?
Yeah, well, a lot of it came from the church.
Yeah.
Yeah, you pick it up, you get older and stretch out and make a dollar here, make a dollar there.
Yeah.
And it just goes from there.
Yeah. Wow, that's beautiful.
You get an award next Sunday? Tell them about the award.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. By the way, nobody never gave me anything.
That's showbiz right there, man.
Yes, indeed. But
So nobody never gave me nothing.
Right, but yeah, I'm gonna receive an award next Sunday, this Sunday.
One of the Heritage Awards. Yeah.
And oh, thank you so much. But it's wonderful. It's wonderful. It's a wonderful experience. And the young guys that are musicians that are here just came in. Oh yeah, hats off to them. Mm-hmm. But y'all got something to look forward to at Stax.
Yeah, because they're students over there at Stax, right?
Oh, right.
Stax Academy, yeah.
I was telling these guys, I was a musician at Stax back in the 70s, and I had a chance to record with most of the writers and Rufus Thomas and Eddie Floyd, Mack Rice, Homer Banks. All of them came through, that was the deal back then, you know. And
it's a roster of people.
Hmm?
It's a roster of people that you can meet.
Oh yeah, no doubt. Yeah, it was the experience of it, like you said. But I saw Eddie a few weeks ago. We got an award. He got an award. I was being awarded with along with my family and my little brother, and I was talking to Eddie. I was talking about the old days. That's what we did. That was our job. 'Cause we played with the Temprees too, and it was like a family thing almost. It was like that. Carl Thomas, Marvell Thomas.
'Cause you were part of the guys that were working and the other studio doing the writing and the making of the music.
Yeah.
And then you would pass it over to the other guys that were going to make the record.
Like Willie said, they had the main job, Studio A.
Of tracking it.
Of tracking it.
And you were in Studio B writing it.
Studio C and B.
Yeah.
And then Eddie Floyd took us down to cut Soul Street, and that Soul Street happened with him. And Rufus did the same thing. Because I was one of the last musicians to come into Stax before it closed. And our group was.
I have Soul Street over here. We're going to play it in a minute. And that's you playing on it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so.
So were you. Were you
12
or?
Were you 12?
How old were you when you started playing?
I was about 19 or 20 when I got to Stax, so we was just learning out how to play and playing out same time, and so that's what Stax was. It was like a university, like you know, that's where you learned how to.
It was a working education, though.
What advice could you give to these guys here?
Get out of the business. Run far away.
Practice. And then if that don't work, practice some more.
You keep practicing. And just when you think you got it, practice some more.
Yeah, it comes down to it because it's never over. You're always a work in progress, you know, in process.
Yeah.
And so... Willie mentioned Muhammad Ali. Muhammad Ali was kind of like that. He was like bigger than life. I was in L.A. I had a chance to play a award show, and Muhammad Ali was a keynote speaker, and he was this larger than life character.
He was a mountain of a man.
Yeah,
he was enormous.
He was bigger than he looked.
Oh yeah,
he thought he was, you know, and
another
sweet
guy.
But he was cool though, man. He was like your big brother.
Yeah,
and That's what he was like, though. He was like, he's gone, you know. But, you know, of course, we know he was a tough guy, too. But he never flaunt the fact that he was a pugilist or nothing like that.
Right.
He was just a cool kid, you know.
He was actually a very good role model. For a lot of the young black kids out there at the time, they needed somebody like him, show that, hey, I can do this too. And Ali was good about sitting with the kids and going, yeah, you can.
That was good.
He was a sweet guy for that.
Like I met Ali three different times.
Yeah,
I met him once in New York. He was on the David Frost show. We was up there with the Temprees playing. We playing in Boston. And we took our little furlough in New York. And they was hawking people to step into the David Frost show because they was from the tape. And we just happened to be walking down the street, you know, the rhythm section I played with. And they said, hey, man, we're going to do Ali and Charlton Heston and Yvette Memonuk and Paula Keller. They're going to come on now. He said, man, let's go do this. We ain't doing nothing but walking down the street. And Ali, his titles had been taken away from him. But he was doing his talk. He was making all the colleges and the TV circuit. He was talking to people, and he was saying something about Charlton Heston. He said, when I get my title back, I'm going to play in movies like you. He said, because you are a hero to your people because you played Ben-Hur and Moses and all that. And he said, I'm gonna do what you're doing. And Charlton was looking at him. He was paying some compliments.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and he was just kind of, he almost skin off his neck.
Nah.
And he said, I'm going to make some movie too. And he eventually got his title back. And so we was in there talking. I said, he was a three-time champion. And when I met him again, seven years later, he had regained his titles. He had been a three-time champion. And I was sitting there talking to him, and I was playing. I had the pleasure of playing the song, The Greatest, for him. And so we talked, and I was talking. We took some pictures, and he signed some autographs. And he was just a gentleman.
Yeah. Yeah, just a nice guy all the way around. Yeah.
Mississippi, no. Memphis, Tennessee.
Eddie Floyd at Radio Memphis in the classic Soul Street, right out of the Stack Studios there.
All bookmarked.
And you got the young guys teaching the old guys a couple of things over here. What's all this about? So usually the other way around, Mark.
Well, you know. Okay, I want him to find on the internet.
Oh yeah, yeah.
It's right there.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So you can run back to it whenever you want to.
Getting y'all squared away.
Yeah, okay. You're back on air.
Yeah, we're back on.
Okay, we're back on air. Yeah, we just in here doing some reminiscing and talking over old times and different stuff.
I know that being a musician at the time that you guys were really, you know, hitting it.
Yeah.
It was a different. Memphis was very different, and I guess somewhat difficult too. You know, you had the civil rights thing that was going on at the time.
Yeah, all kinds of stuff was going on in the 60s.
And you guys 70s. Were traveling so much.
Yeah.
And you mentioned, of course, Europe and overseas, and I'm sure that you were treated so much better over there than you were here at that time.
You didn't believe it.
Oh yes.
Yeah, I would think, and you know, I hate that was the case, but I mean that was the sort of, that was the time, and it's not an excuse, but it was just something that you guys had to deal with throughout your careers, especially starting out so young.
Every musician from Memphis basically went through that.
Yeah.
And it's the same story once they get back. You're appreciated wherever you go.
Yeah. Yeah, and well, you know, thank God for that. I mean, it's
oh yeah,
that's it, but it's unfortunate that you had to go out, be a part of the British invasion to come back in, you know,
to make a living.
Yeah, I can only imagine, you know, not that I'm anywhere near trying to be sympathetic toward it. I tell a lot of people that live through that, it's like I can be empathetic. I think I can understand it. But I've never lived that. I've seen it happen, and I've.
But there's one thing about it. You travel, you can do all the traveling you want, but there's no place like Memphis, Tennessee.
Yeah,
it's no place like home.
That's true.
You're eager to get back. You're eager to get back.
Yeah,
yeah, that's true.
And it's still that way.
Yeah.
To this day, it's, you know, I've very rarely, of late since I've started here, but. When I travel, it's nice, so nice to come home because now it's like I'm amongst my people now. I feel
you
like
you can relax, you can kick your shoes off.
Exactly. I feel like I can communicate with everybody again.
Oh, yes.
You know.
Oh, yes.
And I know that with being an artist and you go out and you get out on the road and you're doing, God, you guys must have played 200 shows a year or more, and then you'd be gone for so long and then you come home even just for the holidays and it was like, oh, God, I don't want to go back out again.
But you look forward to it the following year.
No doubt about it.
Yeah.
You have to get out and go and get it.
Well, that's where the money was, yeah.
And it's a shame that it had to be that way, but that's the way it was.
Sure, sure. You know, when Otis died, all the, you know, the plane crash with the Barquets and all of that and the wild stories that surrounded all of that.
It was horrific. It was horrific.
It was absolutely horrific. And when they came, when everybody finally came back home, it was, at that point, it was for healing, you know, but that was where you found it. You
exactly.
Know? And like, especially at Stax, you know, that was, God, when Dr. King was killed here in 68, and the streets were just crazy and people were going nuts.
Oh, no doubt about it.
But Stax didn't stop.
No, it just kept moving along.
Yeah.
You know, because it was like, well, for the guys that was there, I was there at Stax. That was before my time at Stax, but I heard all the stories about it. Stax was like, because the Butch and MGs was an integrated group.
Yes.
And so it didn't affect Stax, the internal workings of Stax.
But y'all had to kind of, or they had to kind of smuggle Duck Dunn.
Duck Dunn and the Steve Cropper.
They had to kind of smuggle him in there because, you know.
Wayne Jackson was part of that. And I got to know Wayne pretty good. And that was back in the day. They were there with the Marquis before me.
Yeah.
but I heard about it. And,
was Booker T and the MGs still there when you were there, or did they?
No, Booker T had gone when I got there.
Yeah,
I got there in about 1969, 70, 71 when I got there.
And so they had
moved on. Matriculated, yeah. Had gone. Steve Cropper and Duck Dunn were still there.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah, they got a new, they got another organ player to play with them. Al Jackson Jr. still held it down.
Because I know Willie Hall played with them for a little while. In the 80s, I think.
Yeah, he took over from Al Jackson's studio deal, his duties.
Right.
After Al Jackson had gone with the MGs, he had gotten big then.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That was such a fantastic institution over there at Stax. Still is, really.
It still is. I'm talking about back in the day when it was going, it was a going concern. It was like, I'm going to tell you what it was like. Well, to me, being a young guy, it was like Camelot.
Yeah.
I said, I couldn't wait to get to Stax every day because something new and exciting was going to happen that day.
Because you were one of those kids that would sit out on the sidewalk before you got in there dreaming with the other kids.
With the Montego, we used to sit out there in the car and just park out front. Say, one day I'm going to work at Stax. We're going to get a contract at Stax. Of course, we never did, but I ended up working there because the band broke up. But we used to daydream about
working. So how did that happen? Did you just walk in and say, hey, I want to come play and I want to work for you?
I got some kind of way. I got with the Chimprees. And I started working with them at We Produce.
I know those guys.
And, we traveled everywhere. We traveled from Boston to L.A. and all places in between. And that's why I got into Stax. And so I started doing sessions. You know, you go from one job to another when you're at Stax. And then I got to write songs and learned, you know, working with the songwriters. And so it did this. Follow this course.
Yeah, because now then you left Stax, and when did you leave there?
When it closed.
when you couldn't get in the building.
No, Ed Floyd talked about it. He said no. This, and Helen Washington used to do session with us too. She said no. You know this ain't gonna last, don't you? He said Stax when it closed. I was there when it closed. And so it broke up a lot of people's lives when Stax closed. It was like a tragedy, you know.
Oh yeah,
because you know it's say well, don't because you because you're playing your career around Stax. I was gonna grow up in Stax, be a songwriter, musician, producer, and so you had your plan to follow through. But being a Stax is your career, because I was already in, so I was learning stuff, you know. But when Stats closed, it was a sad time. That's not why I ended up going through a place like Atlanta, New Orleans. I got to know Alan Toussaint. I played down there down on Claiborne Street, Canal Street, down Louisiana, different. We went to Lafayette, Lake Charles and stuff, you know. And that's why I ended up going to California.
Well, that's where I was getting at here, is that you had quite the time in Los Angeles.
Yeah, I got around a bit. I got lucky in the way.
You worked in the movie making business?
In the movie industry, yeah. I used to go to this club, Parisian Room, where all the actors hang out, and like Slappy White, Scoy Mitchell, Rudy Ray Moore.
Dolomite, yes.
Yeah, and I met this lady, mentioned the Platters. I know you know her name. I know about you. I never discussed it with you. Zola Taylor. She used to come to the club and all the time. She was a nice looking lady, a nice dress, you know. She was pretty neat, but I found out she had a temper just because something happened to her. I just mentioned that, but anyway.
Now you were involved in a film called, I know it has a horrifying name, but it was The Boss, wasn't it?
or yeah, Boss.
The Boss with Fred Williams from movie.
With Fred Williams, yeah. And
I played the movie score here in Memphis.
Right. You did some of the soundtrack to it. Yeah, and you wound up, I think you took some young lady to the theater and you were trying to tell her that you were involved in this film. And your name, of course, is in the credits.
In the credits. And she didn't believe
you. She didn't believe you.
You ain't played on no movie. I said, yes, I did. So I took her to the movie and she said, there your name is, you know. It was there.
It still is, yeah.
Yeah. Marvell played on it. Bab Wilson played on it. A couple of guys from Motown played on it.
Yeah.
The drummer and Bob Babbitt played on it. Earl DeRuin, I don't remember his real name. I mean, I don't remember his whole name, but he was a drummer from Motown. So Stax Motown.
This was in the mid-70s, early-70s?
It was in the early-70s.
During the blaxploitation film thing, which some of those movies were fantastic.
Yeah, good movies. I saw it on AMC channel last year sometime.
Of course, it's just called Boss.
The Boss then.
Yeah, well, it had a different name.
Yeah, a different name then.
I remember that.
Oh, Willie.
They used the N-word.
Yeah, they did. And you couldn't do that now, of course. Yeah.
When I was in Hollywood, after I got in the movie business, I played a movie. I got a chance to play stand-in in an Alice Haley made-for-TV miniseries called Palmerstown, USA.
Palmerstown, USA.
Palmerstown.
Palmerstown.
It was made up to be Hendon, Tennessee.
Yes.
You know, and it had the facade of a town.
Yeah.
The whole thing. And there's a whole bunch of actors and... I was a stand-in for Glenn Terman Jr. in an episode.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And you also worked with one Betty Davis,
I worked with Betty. I worked with Betty, you know,
she was kind of Betty was kind of sweet on you, if I recall, though.
I don't know about that. But I didn't. I don't know.
But you said she was very nice.
She was a nice lady, you know. But she it wasn't like the reputation of her in her movie role.
Oh, no. Yeah, she always played kind of this bitchy broad. Yeah,
But I got to tell you this. But one day, we were getting ready to do, she was soon to see, I was playing the role for Ernest Hardy Jr. I was his stand-in.
Yeah.
And he had supposed to have gotten hurt in one of the scenes. And he was in the bed hurt. And so for some reason, she said, Jackie, we want you to do a practice with Betty. So I had to get into bed.
You got into bed with Betty Davis.
Yeah.
Look, my man.
She was an older lady then.
It doesn't matter.
It was Betty Davis.
It was Betty Davis. You're in bed with Betty Davis. Yeah.
So she was. She
30
was
guys standing around, but still.
Yeah, that's true, though. But he said, Mark, Betty wants you like that. I said, what do you want me for?
You go get to bed with Betty.
I worked with second team. That was the stars, first team.
Yeah.
But she wanted to practice the scene, you know. And
so you knew some of the lines and you could read with her.
I read with Ernest Hardy Jr. when he practiced.
Yeah.
In the trailer, but I didn't read with her. But I did that practice scene with her, and she was just practicing the scene. So we was in the scene together, and she was looking at me, and I was looking at her. And she was touching me, you know, practicing her.
Oh, yeah.
She was going to help Ernest Hardy getting well, you know. And I'm saying,
you're sitting there, teaching, how did this kid from Memphis wind up in this?
Yeah. Exactly. And,
that's beautiful, though.
And Jackie was standing there, and I could see his shadow in the silhouette because the lights were down and everything. Because it was, you know, because the boy was hurt, you know.
Yeah.
And so Jackson just sitting up on the stool smoking his cigar like he did. Yeah. He smoked a big stogie. And he gave me one, too. I smoked it up.
So right around that time, though, You had roller skating going on. That was the thing.
I used to hang out on Venice Beach.
Yeah.
You know, I used to go. That was my thing. You know, And plus, I could get away from the smog like that.
Sure.
And so I end up learning these roller skate. Oh, I know.
Because you started skating out there, didn't you?
Yes. Well, I knew how to skate, but not like that. It's a different kind.
Oh, it's way different, yeah.
It's a different kind
of dancing and skating.
Dancing and skating in position. You have to have a certain kind of, you have to learn a certain kind of balance. You have to learn how to, the way you learn how to control those wheels, you have to study the figure eights.
Yes.
And you got to learn to go back and forth. I always thought that dance was going to be a like take over, like be a new dance. But I can still do it. But it hasn't taken off yet. It's like a hidden knowledge or something. But that's the way you get control over the wheels is by practicing the figure eight.
So tell me about Boogie Roller then.
Okay. Well, look.
When it starts with you with okay, look, I know where I'm in trouble.
I was on Venice Beach, okay, I was down there skating and just, you know, playing with the radio, listening to the radio. And Give Me the Night came on the radio.
Give Me the Night.
And there was a guy coming by with some film equipment and said, "Hey man, we're getting ready to shoot the video on George Benson right now."
George Benson, yeah.
And so he was getting ready to shoot. I said, "George Benson," because I play George Benson stuff anyway.
Well, sure.
And so I worked in the video, Give Me the Night. That was 1980, 81, something.
So you're one of the skaters in the video?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And so I got to know George, and George had his guitar there. I said, "Man," I said, because I was excited to meet him.
Mm-hmm.
And so we talked about Wes Montgomery and Muhammad Ali. And he said, "Yeah." He went and met Montgomery in Pittsburgh. He said, he has Wes Montgomery to teach him something. He said, "Man, I would teach you, but I'm too busy learning myself." I said, "Well, that sounds about right. Because musicians, you have to pick up what you pick up when you can." And I know he had done the greatest with Muhammad Ali's movie. He said, and he was telling him, talking about Muhammad Ali. He called you little brother.
Yeah.
You know, that's where he was, you know, so he got, you know, of course he got to know George. You know, Muhammad, so we talked for a minute, and I do some dance moves in front of him. He said, "Oh, man, I can't do all that."
And that's how you got into the video.
I was in the video, yeah. We were taking a break and stuff. And so I toured with the idea of doing a roller skate song even before that.
Right.
But when I saw him do it, he was dancing on roller skates. Well, he couldn't do all that fancy stuff, but he could skate on roller skates.
Sure.
You know,
he was comfortable, competent enough to do it.
Yeah, he was. And I said, "Man, I got to do it now." I said,
because it was a thing now.
It was a thing. I said, "I got to do it." So when I got back to Memphis, through by way of Louisville, Kentucky, that's where I first did my first roller skate show, when I danced actually on stage with a band and singing live. Was in Louisville, Kentucky, and I was getting, you know, I had got to learn how to do it, you know.
Yeah.
But I cut the record here in Memphis with some Memphis musicians at Nico Leary's studio,
Cotton Row.
Yeah.
Back when Walt Archie was partner with him, and so I cut it there.
What year was that record?
That was 82 when I first cut it.
Yeah.
Because I cut a couple of times, but that was the final cut, and so I cut the record. I was working in Crystal Palace then. So I ended up going to Houston, Texas. But the idea had always been from the beginning, when I was in L.A., to some kind of way make a video of that record, with that record. And when I got to Houston, Texas, a guy named, it was a DJ with Magic 101 radio, so he had a television show on. And I said, so I got in touch with him. I said, he wanted to do a video, but I wanted to do something like that.
Yeah.
And so I showed him my film from Crystal Palace, what I did for cable TV. And he said, "Man, I got to do this. I'll do it with you. Because you got the record, and we got the idea." And so we cut the video, I'm Just a Boogie Roller.
Yeah.
And so that video turned out to be, was entered in the Houston International Film Festival in 1985, and it won the third place award at that video show.
Wow.
The first place winner was, you ain't gonna guess.
You're right.
But I'm gonna tell you.
Yeah, tell me.
It was Tina Turner's What's Love Got to Do With It.
Really?
Cover, you won first place.
Wow.
And at the award show, I didn't come, something happened in my family. I went back for Christmas, and something happened, and I went back to Louisville, and I stayed because, you know, because something happened. And the presenter of that year, you know, at the awards, at the Houston International Film Festival,
yeah,
was Kirk Douglas.
Oh, wow.
He handed out the awards that year.
Wow.
And I wasn't there.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Wow.
And that's the Boogie Roller story.
Well, I want to play it.
Yeah, let's hear it.
Let's hear it. I'm just
it's
a Boogie Roller.
It's kind of decent.
It's kind of decent. It's a hell of a tune, man. It's about as disco as it gets.
Yeah, it's disco, all right.
You said that like you got a bad taste in your mouth.
No, but it was disco.
We all kind of shrug our shoulders at disco. But, hey, some good music did come out.
Yeah, it did. And I enjoyed doing it. I said, look, the guys I used to play with, Melvin Robinson was on drums. Funky John was on bass.
Yeah.
Frank Westbrook was on keyboard. Then my friend Howard Branch, he played some guitar on part two, but he played it with me. And so we got Boogie Roller.
Well, here it is.
I'm just a boogie roller. I've got my A-wheels in motion. I feel the rhythm in my soul.
Getting up close to the wee bitchin' hour, as they call it. I got a laugh out of that joke. I can't believe that happened. Mark Anthony Lee is in studio. Willie Cunningham is here as well. And I know it's. I know you guys are
Covington.
Excuse me, Covington. My apologies, sir.
I've been called that.
I don't know where that came from. I'm so sorry. Sorry there, Mr. Covington.
It's all good.
I have to remember that they named Covington Road after you, didn't they?
Oh, yeah. They named a whole town after me.
I'll never forget it now.
Let's not leave out the town. Yes, indeed.
I thank you guys so much for coming in, and I know you guys want to get out of here a little bit early tonight, which is great. And it's always a thrill to hear the stories and hear the music that you guys had done over the years. And congratulations again on your award that's coming up next week.
Thank you so much.
The W.C. Handy Heritage
Award,
Music.
Yeah, at the Elvis Presley House. I mean, what is it? It's the Elvis Presley House.
It's the guest house. Yeah.
It'll be about the 7 o'clock tomorrow. I mean, not tomorrow.
Sunday.
It's Sunday. And you can call Heritage Tours. That's for Lane Turner. The number is 527-3427.
Heritage Tours. Look it up. Tours. Call them. Get a ticket for the show.
That's right.
You're the music director for this thing. So,
yeah.
As you've done for years.
Yeah, since inception.
Yeah, well, congrats. What are you going to do for us now before we kick out?
We're going to try a little Bobby Blue Band thing.
All right.
Strumming Monday.
We're going to do a little blue.
Well, come on. Let's go.
Okay.
They call it Stormin' Monday, but Tuesday is just as bad. They call it Stormin' Monday, but Tuesday's just as bad. They say Wednesday's worse, and Thursday's also sad. They say the eagle flies on Friday, Saturday I go out and play. Oh, the eagle flies on Friday, Saturday I go out and play. Sunday morning I go to church and kneel down on my knees and pray. I said, Lord, Lord, have mercy on me. I said, Lord, and Lord, and Lord, and Lord, and Lord, hey, Lord, have mercy on me. I've been trying to find my baby. Won't you sit on home to me? Play the blues, son. Mercy on me. I said, Lord, it, Lord, it, Lord, it. Lord, have mercy on me. I've been trying to find my baby. Won't you send on home to me? Oh, yeah. Stormy Monday Blues, y'all.
Sweet, sweet sound. Very nice.
Stormy Monday Blues.
Right on, gentlemen.
Good job with it.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. Willie Covington from Covington.
I finally got it right.
Damn it. Be keeping me up all night.
Fans for everybody at the Handy Awards, day Sunday, 7 o'clock at Elvis Presley House.
Mark Anthony Lee.
All right.
Leaving that down there for you. Thank you so much, fellas. Anytime you're in the neighborhood, want to stop in and say hello.
Thank you so much.
You're more than welcome, man. We built this place for guys like you.
I love it.
That's what it's all about.
I love it.
Great, great. Thank you.
Hi, this is Reverend Oma from the Broom Closet Metaphysical Shop. The Broom Closet is your one-stop shop for all of your metaphysical needs, such as candles, gemstones, herbs, gifts, and more. We now also stock CBD oil, vape kits, lotion, and edibles. The Broom Closet is also host to monthly workshops, rituals, and drum circles for those interested in conscious living. The Broom Closet is the only place to get your cards read by me, Reverend Oma, or one of our other amazing readers. Discover the Broom Closet Metaphysical Shop in historic downtown Memphis or online at thebroomclosetmemphis.com. The Broom Closet. Let us help you light your path.
Here's what's coming up on the next episode from Radioland with Rick Cheddar.
Tendria is here. How are you?
Hi.
What's going on?
Yeah.
Hey. Good. Yeah, you just out roaming the streets and decided to, you know, come crash into the studio and come hear some blues.
Yeah, I wasn't ready to come home yet. I was at a church thing, so I said, up the street from the studio.
Now it's time to get into the devil's music, see?
We were just talking about that.
Robert Johnson.
Ooh. Ooh. Stones in my pathway. Hellhound on my trail. Look out. Well, glad you stopped in. We're just getting started here with these guys, and we're gonna, because you're from Greenville, Mississippi.
Yes, I am.
That's
Delta.
That's all blues down in there. I know you love the blues.
Yes. And it's funny how Radio Memphis kind of brought that back to me because I lost it for so long.
Yeah.
Because I grew up with it.
Yeah.
That's all I knew.
For previous episodes, go to radio-memphis.com. To download episodes to your mobile device, search the show in iTunes, player.fm, stitcher.com, Pocket Cast, or TuneIn. And now, here's more with Rick Cheddar from Radioland.
And there you go, coming up next week. Yeah, that's going to be a big show. That was a lot of fun. It's the world's most dangerous band. We've renamed the band, I think. I don't know. We had so much fun with that whole show. But yeah, if you missed it, you're not going to on this time. The Delta Project, also an appearance on that program from our friend Mr. John D'Amato. So there you go, kids. That's what's happening next time. So there, that's it. I'm done. I'm out of here. Episode 249 is in the can. Wow, 250 is coming up next time. Wow. I'm sure we'll be talking about that then. So in the meantime, please take care of yourselves. Take care of one another. Say no to the Nazis, if you would, please. And stop shooting each other, okay? I'm Rick Cheddar. And this has been From Radioland.
Rick Cheddar from Radioland is produced by Pirate Radio Studios Incorporated, Memphis, Tennessee. All music performed during this episode was used by permission. No part of this program can be rebroadcast or used in any other way except by written consent. For bookings and other inquiries, you can write the show by sending an email to radioland@pirateradiostudios.com. For more, go to radio-memphis.com.